This is a very exciting book toward the back of your New Testament. The central theme seems to be that the covenant of Jesus is a better covenant than the covenant of Moses. The whole book can be understood as a dialogue between these two poles of Old Testament and New. Notice the number of times through this little book that the word better than appears. We're going to find it once in the first chapter in verse 4 where it says that Jesus is much superior to the angels. The other places we find this same motif are in chapter 6, verse 9, chapter 7, verse 7, 19, 22, 8, 6, 9, 23, 10, 34, 11, 16, 35, 40, 12, 24. Think of the number of times these two covenants are compared. I think it's going to be a tremendous study, and I hope you'll begin to read the book of Hebrews through. Today we're going to be in chapter 1. This is a very exciting chapter as far as some insight into how God has revealed himself and also into the purposes of the incarnation. We're going to see the primary focus of Jesus' coming was to fully reveal God the Father, in verse 2, and to expiate man's sin, verse 3. We find in these opening chapters Jesus fulfilling all the Old Testament anointed offices of prophet, priest, and king. So I hope you'll look for those as we go through verse by verse. The author of this book has been greatly debated through history. Calvin said for certain that he didn't think Paul was the author. I think the tradition in most Bibles has come from the Textus Receptus, which attributed this book to Paul. But from the very beginning of the Christian centuries, there was great doubt about who wrote it. Origen said that God only knows who wrote it. Luther said he thought Apollos wrote it. Tertullian thought that Barnabas was certainly the author. Harnack, a later Christian historian, thought that Priscilla was the obvious author. We really don't know. It seems the vocabulary and style and thought patterns just don't fit Paul. But what we have here is a great man of God, highly inspired, with some tremendous insight to the relationship between the Old Testament and the New. It seems to be written to Jewish Christians who were on the brink of going back into the synagogue because of the tremendous persecution that had come upon the early church. With that in mind, let's begin chapter 1, verse 1. It was bit by bit and in many different ways that God in olden times spoke to our fathers through the prophet. Now, King James starts with God spoke, but that's not put first in Greek because that is not what's being emphasized. It's the manner in which God spoke. The little phrase, bit by bit and in many different ways, is trying to tell us something about the way God revealed himself in the Old Testament. No one prophet or prophets had all the message, but each one had a central part of the truth. Amos and Hosea, their extreme concern was social justice. We have Moses giving the law. God spoke in very dramatic ways through Ezekiel and Jeremiah. He spoke in very poetic ways through David and the authors of the Psalms. So little by little, each was adding his unique piece of evidence and revelation concerning God. Notice where it says that God in olden times spoke. I think it's very important that we affirm that the Bible is God's self-revelation. It's not man's discovery. We can't search for God with our wisdom or intellect or experience. God pulled the curtain back on himself and allowed man to know who he was and what he was about. It's interesting to me that it says in olden times. This is the word that we get the word eschaton from. It means last. There's been some great debate down in verse 2 where it says, but in these latter days, what exactly this word is referring to. I personally believe that it's referring to the old two Jewish ages, the current evil age dominated by wickedness and the age to come when the Messiah would break into history. It seems that from Bethlehem to the second coming of Christ, these two ages have been overlapped. And we live in the last days and have been living in them for a long period of time now. How long they last, we really don't know. Notice where it says, but in these latter days, he has spoken to us through, now mine has a son. There is no article here. It's an authoress. When a Greek noun has no article, it's trying to emphasize the quality or character of the noun and not the specificity of the particular noun. So we're not talking about Jesus here as much as we're talking about the concept of sonship as over against prophets. So the first thing compared is that Jesus is better than the Old Testament prophets as far as the manner or means or methodology of the revelation. Whom he appointed. Now before I get into this, I think it's very important. There are seven things here said about Jesus. the most tremendous Christological passage we have anywhere in the New Testament. I really feel like it rivals John 1. I feel like it rivals Philippians 2. And it's a Christocentric understanding of the scope of who Jesus is. See if you can find those seven things. First, it calls him the lawful owner of everything. Now, I think that goes back to Psalms 2:8. It's reflected in the New Testament in Romans 8:17 and Galatians 4:7. It's speaking of the fact that Jesus is the rightful owner because he's the heir, he's the son. And because we know him, we are heirs too. It's important when it says he was appointed. We're dealing with an aorist tense verb here that speaks of the complete unit of thought. Now, before I go on, I missed the point that I want to bring out. When it says that God has spoke to us through a son, we're talking here about special revelation. God dealing with us in who he is, the person. There is a concept known as natural revelation. I think we find it most clearly in Romans chapters 1 through 3. But here it's very special revelation about who Jesus is and what he's revealed to us as God. Notice the second one, through whom he made the worlds. The agent that God used for creation was Christ Jesus. John 1:3, Colossians 1:16, 1 Corinthians 8:6. I think it goes back not so much to a Greek philosophical background, though logos of John 1 is reflected in this understanding, but I think we're going back to the Hebraic understanding of Proverbs 8:22 and following, where wisdom is the firstborn of creation that God uses. It's not speaking about a time element, but it's speaking about wisdom in a personified way. The last word here, he made the worlds, that's not a real good translation. It's the word ages. It speaks about the invisible and visible world. It speaks about before there was time and when there'll be time no more. Jesus is the creator of all things, invisible and visible. Notice he says he is the reflection of God's glory, number 3. This is the word effulgence. Jesus is not like the moon that reflects the light of God. Jesus is the very light from God. He is the radiance of God. You might want to see John 3:17 and 18, Colossians 1:13 and 14, where Jesus is spoken of as the light of the world. The concept of God's glory here, I think, goes back to Exodus 33:18 and following, about the Shekinah glory, as the rabbis would call it, or the cloud that symbolized the presence of God that was later taken over by the Ark of the Covenant. Then number 4, the perfect representation of his being. Now in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, in Colossians 1:15, we have a Greek word used to speak about Jesus being the image or likeness of God, and it's the word icon. It speaks of likeness or image, but this is the Greek word that we get the English word character from that speaks of exact representation. It's a stronger term, and it's only used here. I think when we see Jesus, we see God. When we see Jesus kneeling down with the children and loving them, we see God. When we see Jesus forgiving the adulterous woman, we see God's love in action. When we see Jesus raising the dead, we see God's love for man personified. Number 5, continues to uphold the universe by his mighty power. The word uphold here is present tense, speaks of continuous action. You might want to see Colossians 1:17. I think he's speaking not so much of natural law, but of God's providential care moment by moment for his world. And then number 6, after he had procured man's purification from sins. It's an aorist middle verb here. It speaks that he himself completed action, took care of man's sin. Here is the office of Jesus as high priest. Now, a better translation of this Greek preposition, instead of from sins, I like of sin better. I don't think it's saying Jesus died for every one of our sins so much as it's saying he took care of our sin problem. He dealt with the problem of the fall. Many times in the Bible, Jesus is depicted as a sacrifice itself. Here he's depicted as the offer of the sacrifice. And then finally, verse 7, he took his seat at the right hand of God's majesty. Remember the little girl who came home from Sunday school and said, "You know, Mama, God can't even move." The mother said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, Jesus is sitting on his right hand." Well, I don't think it's talking about God having a literal body and throne, but it is speaking of the fact that the Hebrew idiom of the right hand is speaking of power, authority, prestige, and that's, of course, what Jesus has been fully endowed with. The idea of seated here is, of course, the concept of king. The seated idea may come from Psalms 110:1. It's reflected in Luke 22:69 that Jesus, all his work is finished, and he is now set down as our mediator, 1 John 2:1. And then in verse 4 and following, we're going to be dealing with some Old Testament quotes that the author is going to back up what he said about this revelation. It's my great privilege to have a good friend of mine here, Dr. Dan Kent, professor of Old Testament at Southwestern Seminary. He's a revival at our church this week, and he's consented to come and talk to us a bit about Old Testament quotes in the New Testament. Dan, what do you think about the author's use of these Old Testament quotes here?
Really, the New Testament authors use the Old Testament in several different ways. Sometimes they would quote directly from the Hebrew Old Testament. Quite often, they would quote from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was completed about 200 B.C., the Septuagint, it's called, and that may be, for instance, verse 6, going back to the Septuagint. Sometimes the writers would just generally paraphrase an Old Testament idea, and then sometimes they would refer generally to some Old Testament idea. And there are times when it's hard to tell which is which, because there are some variations.
How much do you think is the Jewish hermeneutic about picking up on a word or phrase and just using it in a different context?
I think that some of the Old Testament prophets, the books of the Old Testament prophets, are anthologies organized around catchwords. And that would be in line with the question that you just asked. There's a catchword, for instance, that seems to trigger a response. It doesn't sound very logical according to our way of thinking today, but it was quite common back in those times.
Right. I want to mention again that what seems funny to us about proving himself to be as much superior to the angels, we're moving into the second category now of Jesus being superior than the angels. And the rabbinical background seems to be that the rabbis saw the angels as the intermediaries of the law.
Yes.
And somehow as jealous of man for taking their special place. Let me give a couple of quotes and let you comment on it. Deuteronomy 33:2, Acts 7:18 and 53, and Galatians 3:19 seem to reflect this some.
The passage in Acts is Stephen's speech before the Sanhedrin, and he mentions the Jewish tradition that God gave the law through angels to Moses. When the writer of Hebrews says that Jesus is superior to angels, it's not just that he's talking about important heavenly beings or spiritual creatures, but he's talking about the legal system of the Old Testament, including Moses as the lawgiver.
Dan, you were mentioning to me how much problem is caused by verse 6 in the King James translation. Would you tell us your perspective on what it means when it says the angels are turned to wind and fire?
The Hebrew verse, which is, are we talking about verse 6 now or 7?
Excuse me, verse 7, yeah.
Okay, verse 7 is a quotation from Psalm 104:4, and the Hebrew, as I understand it, says that the Lord uses natural elements like the wind as his agents or his messengers. Now, the word messenger, as you know in Hebrew and Greek, can also be translated angel, and that is the way the word is presented in the Greek of Hebrews 1:7.
That's so helpful from getting away to this personification of trying to make the wind an angel and the fire an angel. That seems much more logical to Hebrew mind, that God uses all things.
The Old Testament idea is, it's a frequent idea that the Lord uses lightning, he uses storms, he uses rain, he uses the weather, he uses the wind.
Elijah on Mount Sinai.
As his agent, that's right, as his to accomplish his purpose. Of course, that's one responsibility of an angel, to carry out, as a messenger, to carry out the will of God. But the Lord uses other instrumentalities, too.
I was interested when I was looking at this little quote from Psalms 2:7 up there in verse 5, where it says, for to what angel did God ever say, you are my son, today I have become your father? The use of the word son in the Old Testament has been interesting to me. It seems like many times when it's plural, it's talking about the angels. And then when it's singular, it seems to refer to Israel sometime, like in Hosea 11:1, and then to Solomon, like the next quote down here is 2 Samuel 7:14. That'd be a good example of an Old Testament verse taken out of its particular context, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know whether I'd say taken out of context, but there is an additional interpretation given without any doubt. The verse applies initially to Solomon, 2 Samuel 7:14, But let's say there's an amplified application to the Messiah, because Solomon is a type of the Messiah.
Okay. It's interesting to me that this quote from Psalms 2:7 is also reflected in Isaiah 42:1, the servant songs. It seems like the messianic title and the suffering servant is brought together here, and I think that's very interesting.
By the way, at Jesus' baptism, you have those two ideas brought together in the words the Father spoke.
Right, the transfiguration,
yes,
too.
Thou art my Son. You have the Son idea and the suffering servant.
Well, that reminds
my
me of a question
son.
I was going to ask you. What do you think when it says, today I have begotten you? That's the perfect tense, have begotten. Do you think that's referring to the baptism or the transfiguration? Or I think Paul would say it's the resurrection from Romans 1:4. Then again, in Acts 13:33 seems to refer to that. I had a real problem trying to figure that out.
I think one view we ought to consider is the fact that it describes relationship.
More than a time period.
Yes, it is a perfect relationship of Father to Son. It doesn't mean that Jesus, back in eternity, was born,
right,
was begotten as the literal or physical Son of the Father, as some cultic groups say, but rather they are in a relationship that can be described in human terms as Father-Son.
We're going to get back to Dr. Kent and on verse about the firstborn idea and the Arian controversy, but first here's my friend Phil Crenshaw to tell you about some opportunities for you.
You are listening to the International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated with your host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley. We hope you are enjoying the lesson today, and Bob will be back in just a moment. Here is an unusual opportunity for you and a very special offer on this broadcast. We would like to send you a catalog of all the tapes available from Bob Utley's ministry. This includes all radio and television broadcasts, as well as all messages recorded from the pulpit. The list is long, the subject material covering a broad span of topics and Bible teachings. From this list, you may select the cassette tapes you wish to hear and keep, and they will be sent to you postage paid without any cost or obligation to you whatsoever. Now, here is our address. Get pen and paper and write it down so that you can send us your name today. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408. The growth and continued ministry of this broadcast is dependent upon your prayers and faithful support. We do appreciate your gifts and free will offerings. This is the lifeline of our remaining on the air. Would you join us as a prayer partner and continuing supporter? All your gifts are tax deductible. For those who contribute to this ministry during the month of May, we will send you a 90-minute cassette tape on chapters 21 and 22 of the Book of Revelation. We are praying that these tapes will be a blessing to your life. Now here's our address once again. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408. Now, here is Bob.
There was a real struggle in the early church over who is Jesus, and it developed on some polls in later history between a man named Arian and a man named Athanasius, and one of the proof texts of Arianism was this firstborn son into the world. Dan, what do you think about that firstborn? Is that relationship again more than any kind of time element?
Yes, I think it describes Jesus' relationship to the Father, and it also has something to say about Jesus' relationship to all other children of God. The idea of Father to Son, of course, God is greater than can be comprehended by our minds or described by our language, and we struggle to find language to try to put into words what we believe, and this is one of the words, if it's taken too literally, taken too extreme, it can cause problems. But if it's taken in the proper sense, it can also have a great deal of doctrinal meaning.
It's that intimate relationship of the Jewish home between a loving father and a son that's emphasized, not the time element or the sexual element or anything.
No,
right?
That's correct.
Let me give you a few verses of what Dan was talking about in the relationship, not only with God, but with us. Romans 8:29, Colossians 1:15-18, Revelation 1:5. All of these deal with Jesus' relationship to us, being the firstborn from the dead, the firstborn as God's purpose for our lives. And then Luke 2:13-14 is another example of this. Let me move down to verse 8 and following. There's been some debate on how to translate this because of it's not real sure whether it's evocative or a nominative form when it talks about God's throne. It seems to be an affirmation of the deity of Christ, and yet there is some doubt about translation when it says, "Your throne, O God, will stand forever and ever." Dan, would you see this as a translation deal referring to Yahweh of the Old Testament, or would it be something you think that might be affirming the deity of Christ by putting a title on him that was given to God?
The early Christians were not hesitant to do this. For instance, the word that's translated Lord in the New Testament is the same word that is used in the Old Testament to refer to Jehovah God. When the early Christians said of Christ, "Christ is Lord, Jesus Christ is Lord," they were putting him on a level with God in the Old Testament. They were saying Jesus is God. And I've always taken verses 8 and 9 as attributing to Christ the attributes of divinity which are rightfully his.
Right. Down in verse 10, you might see in your translation the word Lord there. Now, that's not in the Hebrew text. That's from the Septuagint, which was added. And the early church used that quite often of Jesus, and they died by the hundreds because they wouldn't say Caesar is Lord because of the uniqueness that name had for them. Notice the word anointed there in verse 9. So God, your God, anointed you. This is the word that means Messiah, or often translated Christ. That's why I think that Jesus fulfills these three offices in himself of the Old Testament anointed ones, prophet, priest, and king. And Dan, I'm not going to tell you where they are, but they're in this chapter. I hope you'll go back and look when we get through and see if you can find the verses that speak of that. Dan, I was talking to you earlier about how I struggle some with this, with the oil of exaltation beyond all your companions. Why he would mention that all your companions from Psalm 45, 6 and 7, and what you kind of think he means there about companions.
By the way, the New International Version says with the oil of joy, but everybody agrees on the translation of companions. I take that to mean that Christ has a position superior to anyone else, to any other person, to any other creation. There may be divine beings like angels. There may be human beings who have trusted Christ, who are children of God. Any principalities, any powers, any levels, Christ is exalted in a superior fashion in comparison with all of these.
Well, that's beautiful. I think that's so true. Down in verse 11, it mentions that some of these earthly things of the heavens, like heavenly bodies that the ancients were so caught up with, thinking that deities were behind them and they control men's destinies. Here, in the Bible's view is that God controls these heavenly bodies and the works of his hands. In verse 11, it says, "They will perish, but you will always remain," speaking of Messiah. You think that's possibly where Peter, 2 Peter 3:10, got the idea of the elements passing away, and Jesus refers to the Word abiding forever?
Being rolled up, laid aside,
right,
like an old pair of clothes, old suit of clothes. But, of course, he continues. In the Old Testament, you have the picture of the grass fading, withering,
right,
the flower fading, but the Word of God stands forever.
That's a great promise, too, isn't it?
In the New Testament, Jesus said there wouldn't a jot or a tittle pass till all was fulfilled, and, of course, it was in him.
In the last part of verse 12, it says, "But you are the same, your years will never cease." That reminds me of the beautiful passage in Hebrews 13:8, where it says, "Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever." This little thing in verse 10 through 12 is a quote from Psalm 102, 25, and 27. Dan, we've got 2 minutes left. Could I get you to comment on that beautiful passage that's quoted last, Psalms 110:1, this messianic psalm? How do you think it applies to Jesus?
There is a whole category of messianic psalms, and any way you study the psalms, whether you classify them by content or by form, you still come out with a royal or messianic category. I think this is another way of saying that Jesus is superior to angels, because God the Father never said to any other heavenly being, "Sit at my right hand." That place is reserved for the one and only Son. And, of course, all of his opponents will eventually be put under his feet.
That's the ancient custom of putting your foot in the neck,
right,
of an enemy.
In Joshua, you see this. Joshua called the kings out of the cave.
Right.
And put their feet on their necks.
I've enjoyed so much having Dr. Dan Kent being with me today. He's a good friend. I hope you'll write us. If you have some questions about the Old Testament, I'll pass them on to Dan, and maybe we could deal with them. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you.